given shape, so much is distorted. Because that's part of what it does. It's a magnifier in a way. It can make good people great and bad people awfulish. Life becomes lifelike. I was watching a documentary about New Guinea, and a man from one of the tribes there was marveling at how much stuff Americans seem to need. Why you all have to have so much cargo? Well, to me, that's partly what celebrity is. A massive amount of cargo. Cargo and spectacle. You know who I am, therefore I am. Or, perhaps more to the point, you know who I am, therefore I must be someone, right? Anyway, it radiates out of me. Ooh, how indifferent I am. And that was a big deal for Michael Jackson because you'd see people around him who would completely transform. They would become idiotic. It was as if they were, meeting someone dead, which of course he now is. He was so famous that he transcended humanness. Jesus Michael Jackson Christ. His fame distorted whichever situation you were in with him. His otherness actually overwhelmed his gifts a lot of the time, which was quite a feat, because I know I bring no news when I say he was a very gifted human being. I'm fairly certain that I first met Michael in Arnie Klein's office around the time Billy was born, which makes it about 18 years ago. Bruce Wagner, the writer, is one of her godfathers, and Arnie is the other. Billy would call Arnie Godfather, too. When Billy was about 6 months old, Michael saw pictures of her in Arnie's office, called and left me a message in that odd voice with its own dialect. It was like he was his own country. His message was an extraordinary thing. In a way, it was like getting a communication from Santa Claus or some fairy tale character. Michael said that he wanted pictures of Billy. Now, that was odd. But, you know, also, given that all that court case stuff hadn't happened yet, kind of sweet. It was like he identified with or was drawn to all things innocent. And yet everyone turned that into something perverse. No one could believe that he was that innocent or that his motives were innocent. But I kind of did. But getting back to the special medical access I was discussing earlier, I had this dentist at the time, a Dr. Chandler, who was this really strange man. He was the, dentist to the stars. And I'm proud to say that I am one of the few people, actually the only one I've ever heard of, though I'm sure there must be others, who would have unnecessary dental work just for the morphine. And this man was one of those people who provided such a service. He referred his patients to a mobile anesthesiologist who would come into the office to put you out for the dental work. And as if that wasn't glorious enough, he could also be easily financially persuaded to come to your house to administer the morphine for your subsequent luxury pain relief. A man whose license plate was Sleep, M.D. And I would put my arm out, veins akimbo, and say to Sleepy Doc, two dwarves in one package. Send me away, but don't send me all the way. But remember that dentist who sued Michael for molesting his kid? You might be able to see where I'm going here. Yes, that was my dentist, Evan Chandler, DDS. And being the dentist to the stars, Dr. Chandler, before the lawsuit was brought, though not necessarily before it was contemplated, needed someone to brag to about his son Jordan's burgeoning friendship with Michael Jackson. This was years before Michael had children of his own. And so my dentist would go on and on about how much his son liked Michael Jackson and, more importantly, how much Michael Jackson liked his son. And the most disturbing thing he said was, "You know, my son is very good-looking." Ugh! What father talks about his child that way? Well, maybe some do, but A, I don't know them, and B, they probably aren't raising an eyebrow and looking suggestive when they say it. Over the years, I've heard many proud fathers tell me, "My son is great," or "My kid is adorable." But this was the only time I'd ever heard this particular boast. My son, unlike most average male offspring, is very unsettling smile, raised eyebrows, maybe even a lewd wink. Good looking. Pause for you to reflect and or puke. It was grotesque. This man was letting me know that he had this valuable thing that Michael Jackson wanted, and it happened to be his son. But it wasn't who his son was, it was what he was. Good looking. He was essentially pimping his son. So here was Dr. Chandler telling me how Michael was buying his kid computers and taking him to incredible places and sleeping in the same bed and getting him... Wait! Hang on, I said. I have to interrupt here. Let's just go back a tick, okay? Sure, Chandler said. They're sleeping in the same bed? He blinked. Well, yeah, but my ex-wife is always there, so it's okay. And his stepfather and... Dr. Chandler's stories became longer than my treatments. The drugs were wearing off before the story. Not that there was enough dope in the world to make these stories palatable. This was one creepy story. Offhand, I'd say the creepiest. And somehow I'd become this freak's confidant. So I told this bizarre tale to my friend Gavin DeBecker, who specializes in, among other things, celebrity weirdness, with a particular expertise in protecting celebrities from stalkers. Yes, he is the bodyguard to the stars. He's written 4 books about fear and security and the like. So I told Gavin about this dentist dumping this ghastly tale of his son and Michael Jackson in my lap, and Gavin told me, "Here's what you should say to the guy. Okay, let me get this straight. You're telling me your son is having sleepovers in the same bed as Michael Jackson. Let me put this to you another way and tell me if you think this is okay. Your 13-year-old son is sleeping in the same bed as a 30-something African-American millionaire. Is that okay with you? Or does it need to be Michael Jackson to make this incredibly flawed situation make sense?" I said this to Chandler, and, as I dimly recall, we didn't speak much for a while after that. Then, one night, some months later, Dr. Chandler came up to my house again and told me that he and his wife were going to sue Michael. "Why?" I asked. "Because," he explained rationally, "Michael is sleeping in the same bed with my boy." Now, I know for a fact that when this first started happening, the good doctor saw no problem with this odd bunking. Excuse me, but he had been creepy enough to have allowed all this to happen, and now he's suddenly shocked, shocked, virtually consumed with moral indignation. "Can you believe it? I think Michael put his hand on my kid's penis." Well, what was this guy thinking in the first place? Why did he let him sleep in the same bed as Michael Jackson to begin with? He did it because he knew somewhere he would eventually be able to say, "Oh, my God. Now this thing with Michael is weird. I'm horrified. My son has been damaged, And the only thing that can repair this damage is many millions of dollars. Then he'll be okay. And we're not going to buy anything with that money. It's all going toward our son being okay. This was around the time that I knew I had to find another dentist. No drug can hide the feeling of one's skin crawling. The thing is, though, I never thought that Michael's whole thing with kids was sexual. Never. As in Neverland. Granted, it was miles from appropriate, but just because it wasn't normal doesn't mean that it had to be perverse. Those aren't the only two choices for what can happen between an adult and an unrelated child hanging out together. Even if the adult has had too much plastic surgery and has tattooed makeup on his face. And yes, he had an amusement park, a zoo, a movie theater, popcorn, candy, and an elephant. But to draw a line under all that and add it up to the assumption that he fiendishly rubbed his hands together as he assembled this giant super spider web to lure and trap kids into it is just bad math. I actually don't think Michael was sexual at all. Incredibly talented, yes. Childlike, for sure. Pathologically kind, absolutely. But how stupid would you have to be to have sex with little kids you're endlessly hanging out with? And Michael was not stupid. He was just naive and richer than most anyone in the whole world. And it was this absolutely fatal combination that made people want to desperately try to find out how to squeeze some of that money out of his big fat wallet. But wait, check this out. Let's say your really good-looking son started hanging out with this odd-looking famous multimillionaire that could maybe be persuaded to give you $22 million if you threatened to tell everyone in the world that he touched your son's underage, maybe not even fully grown yet, penis. Well, I don't know what you'd do, but when my dentist was presented with a choice between integrity and $22 million, you'll never guess what he did. Or maybe you will. Yep, he went for the cash. But hey, he was only humanish, right? Come on, who could blame him? Besides you and me and anyone else alive who cares about ruining their kid's life, who else could blame Dr. Chandler for what he did? I'll wait while you think. Moving on. I always felt that a huge part of the appeal of Kids for Michael was that they couldn't be corrupted by his fame. Obviously, a celebrity is a person set apart from the throng, a public persona, someone who not only has a private life, like all humans, but a public one as well. What are they like in real life? What sort of question is that? Oh, he's so nice, people would say after they encounter a celebrity. Incredibly down to earth. Down to earth from where? Where did they get back to earth from? And was it a long trip? Will they go back soon? And why? And will they take me with them? Michael's celebrity turned many people into greedy, scary fucks who only wanted something from him above and beyond what a normal human is willing or expected to give. They were there for the anecdote. It's a thing I call the shine. People want to rub up against it, and in so doing, their own value is increased. But I'd like to propose a reason why Michael might have preferred the company of children to what I've laughingly heard referred to as adults. Here it is. Kids of a certain age, being too young to understand the peculiar phenomenon of fame, are potentially easier to trust and hang out with than adults, who, as I said earlier, more often than not, have a tendency to start acting completely asinine around someone as outrageously famous as Michael. Kids are far less likely to act like that because they don't exactly know what fame is yet. To them, famous is cartoon characters, or Muppets, or Barney. It's too abstract a concept for kids. Kids feel important if they're treated well. They don't need, couldn't compute, feeling better because they're treated well by millions of strangers. Their toys aren't more fun if they cost 3 or 4, maybe even 5 figures. The other people who aren't rendered strange around famous people are other famous people. In such instances, the issue of celebrity is neutralized, and they're free to move on to whatever they like or don't like about one another in the usual human way. So that partly explains why Michael might have enjoyed hanging out with, say, Elizabeth Taylor, for example. Or even maybe me. Yes, that's what all this finally boils down to. Me, 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 me. Anyway, a few years after the first pedophile claims, Arnie's birthday came around and we were invited to Michael's Neverland Ranch to celebrate with Arnie and his multi-bear clan. It wasn't clear whether or not we were going to see Michael, or even that he was there. We were there as Arnie's guests. But then that night, we got called into the house. Summoned, more like. We walked into this dark, cave-like room with dark sofas and this gigantic sound system, curtains drawn. All that was missing was a crystal disco ball. And then there was Michael, in his white pajamas with animals on them. He had stayed up all night in this room dancing. That's what gave him pleasure. He'd go into this enormous dark room at the ranch, and he would stay there by himself, dancing to music all night long. I think that for Michael, this was a way to be okay. I think it was the one way people could not get at him. When he was inside his music, it all made sense. The music took care of him. It was the one thing that didn't want anything from him. It wrapped him up in sound and sailed him away to where he could be safe. Music may have been his truest friend, the only one he could truly trust. Pretentious? Maybe. But that doesn't make it any less true, does it? Cut to another night the following year. I was up at my ex-stepmother Elizabeth Taylor's house. We were going to an AIDS benefit in Beverly Hills. Elizabeth and Michael were going together, and their double date happened to be Shirley MacLaine and me. Part of Michael's relationship with Elizabeth was to buy her jewelry. You might say it was even a big part of their relationship. Elizabeth liked getting jewelry, but hey, who doesn't? I remember coming into her dressing room one time, and she was wearing this diamond as big as a doorknob. So this was the famous diamond Burton had given her. I asked her, "What did you do to get that?" And she smiled sweetly and said, "I was loved." So there we were, Shirley, Elizabeth, Michael, and me, in a limousine driving to the Beverly Hilton Hotel. Our car drove up to the entrance, the car door opened, the four of us spilled out in front of the paparazzi, and Shirley and I were instantly rendered invisible. It was as though we weren't anybody. Michael's and Elizabeth's combined celebrity was just so incredibly intense. It was shine squared. And in a way, it may have been comforting for each of them to have found someone with equivalent, unimaginable celebrity. A rare species, endangered, protected, shiny, shared an uncommon denominator. And after all, isn't that something we all want? Community? This, I think, is largely why Michael would hang around with Elizabeth. They had something amazingly unique in common. They were both stars from a very early age. That's like being pulled out of the general community really early on, being taken away for anything relatable. Obviously, this is a high-class problem, but that doesn't make it any less of something to deal with, does it? So if that happened to you, who knows? You might want to be around children, too. Children who don't understand enough to get weirded out by you. Who just know people are people. Who knows? That night at the AIDS benefit, Shirley and I ended up being spectators to the spectacle of Michael and Elizabeth. All you can really do in a situation like that is watch. And both Shirley and I are celebrities who write, who document, who observe, who in a way feel pulled out of situations that pull you out anyway. We're kind of like war reporters on the front lines of celebrity. But whatever we were like or I was like, maybe one of the reasons Michael was comfortable with me was that in a way we could understand a part of each other that nobody else could. The princess and the king, Leia and Pop. Maybe. Or maybe we never knew each other at all. Who the fuck gives a shit ultimately, right? On Christmas Eve 2008, Michael's last, I went over to his house, which is located just down the hill from me and a few blocks over. He was giving his children the childhood he never had, a childhood outside of celebrity with people who didn't objectify them. Because normally for Michael, life was like being an animal at the zoo, an endangered species forever behind bars. I could get in the cage with Michael and not get freaked out at all. And there weren't that many people who would have known how to, or known that it was even something they might actually be required to do when with him. But I did know. So I joined Michael after hours at his zoo. We took pictures and ate cookies and decorated the tree, just like people. Then Michael asked me to do the Star Wars hologram speech for his kid. I didn't mind. Someone actually had to remind me what a big Star Wars fan Michael was. While I was there, though, we weren't really experiencing the situation for the most part. We were taking pictures of it. Arnie took pictures of me and Michael and the kids, and I took pictures of Arnie and his friends and the Michael family package. My favorite was taking a picture of Michael reading my book Wishful Drinking. I will cherish that weird Christmas configuration forever. It was like Michael didn't know how to just be in a situation without recording it on a camera. The thing is, he was just so used to being documented. But the main reason the documentation came up this time was mostly for Arnie's friends, who wanted to take pictures of their meeting with Michael so they could carry his shine around. It elevated them. It became, oh, I had Christmas Eve dinner with Michael Jackson. What did you do? Anyway, we fucked around and it was fun. We took pictures, we acted childish. At least I think that's what it was. At some point, Michael said, okay, I'm letting you take my kids' pictures because I know that you won't show them to anyone because you know I don't want anyone to see my children. He wanted his children to be as unrecorded as possible. If the Africans believe that you lose a piece of your soul each time you have your picture taken, then Michael hadn't had one for a very long time. And, come to think of it, neither have I. But he was trying to arrange things so his kids could keep theirs. And his children are very sweet, good children. And that's because whatever else he was or wasn't, I think Michael was a really good father. I mean, those kids of his are kind, really polite, even-tempered, and not spoiled at all. And that can't come from a nanny. You can't fake that stuff. It has to come from the parent, Michael. After that night, Michael sent me a present, a phone. A symbol of communication. And just like with the soap I stole from Neverland, I lost it. Michael couldn't do any of the things that normal people do because as soon as he got involved with them, they became toxic with focus pulling and contaminated with shine. And I guess the only times where he could not feel pulled at and objectified was when he listened to the music all night and danced, or when he was being a father. Michael was this creature that entertained us and then baffled us. I don't think he was a drug addict in a conventional way. I think he just wanted out sometimes. And out could be dancing by himself all night with his friend, the music. Or out could be anesthesia, which is not a drug. It provides no high, just nothingness, which must have seemed tremendously appealing to him. To sleep, perchance, not to be misunderstood, get used, have your penis photographed by the police. I believe that Michael was fundamentally inconsolable. What consoles is friendship and family. He had a father who was cruel to him, and though he seemed to love his mother, I don't think he felt like he had a comfortable place in the world. So he made his own little community with his children.
Michael's death was as much a byproduct of his fame as it was of whatever plagues regular humans, whoever that might describe. He died because he could get people, in this case doctors, to give him something he had no business having. No one but a ridiculously wealthy celebrity could have persuaded a doctor to go against his principles, to risk losing his license. The combination of money and celebrity is a deadly surf and turf. Dr. Conrad Murray swapped his reputation in exchange for shekels and the ability to say, "I'm Michael Jackson's doctor." What ophthalmologist or hairdresser or tattoo artist or sobriety expert wouldn't love to have his or her profession defined with that addendum, to the stars? For most people, that's just too fucking much to resist. And now he gets to be the doctor that essentially killed Michael Jackson, linked to him for the rest of his otherwise unnoteworthy life, killer to the stars. And this is merely one sad example of the most prevalent subculture in Hollywood, the professionals who provide special essentials to the special stars with their oh-so-special needs. Hey, in exchange for me allowing you to drop my name and be seen with me on occasion, would you give me a prescription for pills that I don't need but want really bad? My reality, my surreality, has set up housekeeping on my nerves. I've been a public person way too much this week, and now I'm craving a little private oblivion. Not too many people know what it's like to be enshrined in the public eye, so now I don't want to feel like myself, okay? Be a good guy and get me out of me. But then, oops. Maybe I stayed out of myself and off my nerves for a little too long now. Could you maybe find me someone to privately detox me? Then you can be the guy who saved me from myself. Hang a photo of us on your wall. Sure, I'll do your benefit. I'll even show up at your party. Basically, Michael was radioactive famous. And I got a little extra stab of celebrity by being in the vague proximity of the scene of the crime of Michael's life, which ended so early, so much sooner than it should have. But hey, at least we have the Xbox 360 Kinect Michael Jackson experience to remember him by, and his music. It's not much compared to still having Michael. What you'll have of me after I journey to that great Death Star in the sky is an extremely accomplished daughter, a few books, and a picture of a stern-looking girl wearing some kind of metal bikini, lounging on a giant drooling squid, behind a newscaster informing you of the passing of Princess Leia after a long battle with her head. Waiting for the shoe tycoon to drop. If my memories are indeed destined to fade, then let the ones herein contained be among the first to go. Carl Shoe Stores was America's largest privately held retail shoe chain when Harry Carl took it over from his father in 1952. He was a multimillionaire, a phrase that used to carry the cachet that billionaire does today, when he married my mother, and over the course of their 13-year marriage managed to lose not just all of his money, but also all of hers, and to leave her in huge debt for good measure. Prior to making her Debbie Reynolds Carl, Harry had been married twice to the singer-actress Marie MacDonald, whose nickname was The Body. You might conclude from this biographical nugget that he was in some possession of some incredible sexual allure. If so, as you'll soon see, you would be very, very wrong. I was 3 when my mother married him. She was never in love with him. The whole point of Harry Carl was that post-Eddie Fisher, my mother wanted to provide my brother and me with a father who would stay, rather than the kind that would, say, leave and create one of the ugliest scandals in Hollywood history. Somehow, this translated to her as having to find not just someone who valued faithfulness over infidelity, not that Harry turned out to be such a husband, but someone who was the complete opposite of Eddie in every way. Eddie Fisher was a very handsome man. Harry Carl wasn't. Eddie Fisher was insanely charming. Harry Carl was so lacking in charm that my guess is this is probably the first sentence ever composed that contains both his name and that word. Eddie was young and did everything with boyish energy and glee. Harry was fairly old, as it happens, the same age I am now, and spent most of his time in bed sleeping. Eddie spent most of his time in bed not sleeping. Eddie spoke with delight, and when he wasn't talking passionately, he was singing. The world was his shower, and he used women for soap. Harry neither spoke nor sang. He snored in one end and farted out the other. Eddie lived in a faux Asian house in Benedict Canyon. Harry, and therefore we, lived at 813 Greenway Drive, a house poised hesitantly on the edge of a golf course, just below sunset on the western edge of Beverly Hills. It was a massive, embassy-like marble-floored box, possessing all the comforting warmth of a plant that manufactured disinfectant. The dominant color, if it even qualifies as a color, was beige. I'm sure my mom just wanted to live in a nice house, a house that rich people could live in. But coming from the poorest part of the Texas-Mexico border town of El Paso, it was difficult to know exactly what that ought to look like. Not that Harry was to the manor born. He was to the manor boring. He'd inherited the business his father had built coming out of World War II, and because he hadn't taken part in making something out of nothing, he turned out to be better suited to making nothing out of something. But destroying, really destroying something like, say, your wife's life, well, if you want to do it properly, it can take a while. About 12 years in this case, a deceptively comfortable time during which the four of us holed up in our lavish digs, unknowingly waiting for the money to run out so we could pack up and then chase after it. There were bookshelves filled with books that no one read. There was a piano room with a piano that no one played. There was a lanai with a table and chairs and lots of plants and big indoor palm trees that no one went out to ever, ever, ever. There was a dining room with a huge table and giant seats that resembled electric chairs without the electricity. There was a living room where no one lived, with white couches and chairs, and lots of crystal objects. Ashtrays, boxes containing cigarettes, a lighter, figurines of shy nude women, and coffee table books of great works of art that no one ever perused. There was a chauffeur, a chef, a nanny, a butler, a laundress, and a guard, all decked out in the appropriate uniforms, just like in the movies. In the breakfast room, there was a buzzer under the rug, so my mother could use her foot to call for people who were standing 5 feet away. That way, she didn't have to strain her vocal cord shouting, "Mary!" or "Letha!" or "Yang!" or "Mrs. Yang!" She could just buzz. My brother and I had our own rooms, but for many years we slept in the master bedroom with Harry and my mom because it was one of the few times we could spend time with our mother, who worked all the time. These were the early prehistoric days of Hollywood, when people were under contract to studios, casting couches were still in use, and there were no 12-hour turnaround rules, so she was rarely there. If you think of the house as a big letter, we all slept in the little postage stamp in the corner. Harry and my mother in the bed, Todd on a lavender silk couch by the window under a blue blanket, and I on the white carpet on my mother's side of the bed, huddled under a pink blanket. It was a multi-million dollar mansion, but we lived in it as though it was a shack in the Appalachians. Here are a few other recollections I have about Harry. Before he drove Carl's shoes into the ground, he named a shoe after me, the Lady Carrie, and one for my brother, the Lord Todd. He smoked about 5 packs of cigarettes a day. His head was always surrounded by a cloud of smoke, and he was constantly coughing. He walked very, very slowly, as befitted a man who did so much smoking and coughing. He had a diamond pocket watch with a chain attached to his belt loop and a diamond clasp in the shape of the letter H. He was very big on monograms, HK shirts, HK jackets, HK shoes. He drove a deep green Bentley that had a phone in it. There were little wooden trays on the back of the front seats that you could pull down, you know, to play solitaire and build wooden airplanes and boxes out of popsicle sticks. And there was a TV in the mid-60s. Neither the phone nor the TV actually worked, but still, no one else had them. He was among the victims of a famous fixed card game. I think George Burns was another, at the Friars Club, where people hid in the ceiling looking down at the cards. He lost $3 million. So if you've ever wondered what kind of person stays in a card game after losing $1 million, let alone more than $2 million, now you know. He watched a lot of television, so much so that at some point he had a second set put in the bedroom. After that, we used to say, "Harry's upstairs watching TVs." Over the television in his den, there was a picture of him and my mom standing on either side of Richard Nixon from some fundraiser a few years back. Todd and I were not big Nixon fans, and we took endless childhood joy in taking that picture down and hiding it under the sofa. This was a game that, unlike Nixon himself, never got old. After a hard day at the golf course, drinking, not golfing, Harry liked to plop himself down in his chair in the den and read the newspaper. Behind it, he'd be picking his nose, which we couldn't see, but then we would see him doing that thing with his fingers. You know, don't make me say it.
Harry was always well-dressed and groomed. He ought to have been, since a barber came to see him at the house every day. Nighttime was another story. As Harry slept, sans pajama bottoms, causing his privates to be anything but, his horrible, flaccid elephant trunk of a penis was regularly on display. A painful reminder of what would happen if my mother misbehaved. It actually looked kind of like a long ball. Ah, the fabulous waltzing we did at Harry's long ball. Of course he had hemorrhoids, which was probably partly why he eschewed pajama bottoms, leaving him to sleep bare-bottomed on a towel. Yes, with an HK monogram. And because of the hemorrhoids, he had a special toilet, so he didn't have to exacerbate the tissue down there by undue wiping. He would just push this little lever on the side, and it would spray water on his ass, after which he'd push the lever the other way, and a tiny door would open and blast warm air to dry his now shiny, clean anus. This was my favorite thing in the house to demonstrate to my friends. Given what I've told you so far, you won't be surprised to learn that in addition to Harry's previously cataloged attributes, he was also a lifetime member of the Frequent Farter Club. He rarely spoke, apparently preferring to converse flatulently. He communicated in Morse code from his ass. He was almost 20 years older than my mother and had informed her of his impotence early on. I doubt that this was much of a heartbreak for her, for a host of reasons, not the least of which was that his ass crack drove halfway up his back. And oh, about that impotence, it turned out he just preferred to fuck hookers who came to the house pretending to be manicurists. After my mother found out about the manicurists, a gossip columnist named Joyce Haber wrote that the marriage was on the rocks. That night, my mother came into my room, because now all four of us were finally sleeping in separate bedrooms, shutting the door discreetly behind her as she presented to me the article held tight in her hand. "Don't show this to Harry," she instructed me solemnly. Later, the same evening, Harry came to my room, saying and doing almost the exact same thing my mother had done. Clutching another copy of the same paper, he said, "Don't show this to your mother." As if in either case, that was something I would have done. Then, in an effort to keep the family together, we all went to Europe, my first trip there. My most vivid memory of the trip was when we were in Venice, floating along in a gondola, with Harry's hand drifting beside him in the water, the gondola singing his passionate song, la la la. And with the singing in our ears and the Italian twilight glowing around us, Harry's hand slowly came out of the water, holding a wet lump of shit. Are you beginning to see a reoccurring theme in Harry's life? When we got back to the hotel, my brother and I were giggling about the feces that Harry had just been scrubbing off of his hand when he suddenly yet casually appeared in the doorway. I don't remember where my mother was, and announced that he had a joke to tell us. Todd and I were stunned. In more than a decade with Harry Carl, nothing like this had ever happened. Harry simply never spoke, except when he got on the intercom to call out for assistance. It was a miracle. Maybe the shit was magic. "There's an orchestra," he began, "and the first violinist is standing in front of the conductor." Not only was he telling us this joke and speaking in fully punctuated, if somewhat simple, sentences, "and the conductor is conducting and conducting," but he was acting it out, grandly performing the conducting with his arms. And all of a sudden, he smells something that doesn't smell good at all. He made a bad smell face. But the conductor keeps conducting and conducting until after a while he can't stand it anymore. So he turns to the first violinist and asks, Harry mouthed as he continued to conduct, Did you fart? Then Harry started doing the violinist, acting out enormous violin playing movements. And the violinist, with a big smile on his face, and one on Harry's, shakes his head. No, he didn't. No, he did not fart. And Harry kept playing the violin. This was an unprecedented spasm of personality from Harry. The joke that apparently had been pent up inside of him for 13 years now came flowing out as if he'd been a boil that had been lanced by comedy. So the conductor, now he went back to acting like the conductor, he continues to conduct, but the smell is also continuing, so he turns to the first violinist and mouths, Are you sure you didn't fart? And the first violinist has a huge grin on his face, as did Harry, a massive yellow-toothed grin, accompanied by more big violin-playing movements. And he shakes his head. No, most certainly not. Absolutely did not fart. So the conductor continues to conduct. But this unbelievably terrible smell is still there. So now, finally, he looks down at the first violinist and mouths, Did you shit? And now, the first violinist still grinning madly, as was Harry, with more pleasure than we'd ever seen him evidence, nodded yes. And the crescendo with the most enormous, joyous head nodding from Harry, Yes, he did shit. The violinist actually shit right there in the orchestra. From the looks of it, playing Beethoven's Kreutzer Sonata. That, I promise you, was the longest conversation Harry ever had with either of us. Not that it really was a conversation, but it was close. Someone talked, others listened, an understanding of sorts was achieved. The idea of him telling us this joke after having just washed the shit from the canals off his hand will never cease to delight me. Sadly, the European excursion didn't save the marriage. Maybe it would have if my mother had been there to hear about the first violinist. Oi, my papa. I didn't see my father all that much growing up, and as a result, he became a kind of mythic figure to me. I probably knew as much about him as some of his more rabid fans. I'd been told stories about how he would make plans that he was going to come pick up Todd and me and then not show up. So that by the time I was 3, when someone would say to me, Your dad's coming? I would shrug and say, Maybe. Several years later, after his marriage to Elizabeth Taylor was over, he lived in an Asian-looking house in a development called Beverly Estates, up on a hill overlooking, of all things, other Asian-looking houses in what is now Benedict Canyon. Now, my dad was not what you might think of as an industrious-type person. I mean, if you could have something done for you, my dad would have it done for him, obviously with the exception of having sex. So, to assist him in his very basic existence, he had this very capable, imposing black man, Willard, who he referred to as his butler. Willard, who actually was dressed like a butler, in a white jacket and black pants, pretty much took care of my dad for about 20 years. You might say he made my father, an extremely charming, womanizing drug addict, possible. He looked after him and cleaned up after him and even fed him on the rare occasions that he ate because by then he was shooting speed, courtesy of the original Dr. Feelgood, Max Jacobson. I remember this one time when my dad was living with this beautiful Scandinavian Playboy model named Ula, and Todd and I were going to spend the night with him. Amazing, right? A sleepover at Dad's. My brother and I had gone to his house for one of our rare visits. But somehow, my mom found out that he was living in sin with this Playboy model chick. So, when the four of us got back from the movies, there was my mom's Cadillac in the driveway, with her leaning against it, furiously smoking a cigarette. She waited while we gathered up our overnight bags and drove us home in uncomfortable silence, Todd and I staring gloomily into our laps. This other time, when I was like 13, I remember taking a walk with him down the road near his house. So, you know, what do you say to a stranger who really didn't know how to ask questions and coincidentally happened to be your father? I mean, our exchanges never really went much beyond an assortment of, how are you? Or, what grade are you in now? Or, what's your favorite subject? This time, though, he turned to me quite casually and said, I see you're developing breasts. Oddly enough, I didn't really know how to respond to this. I mean, it would have been different if he'd been more of a, well, what some people might think of as a regular sort of father, you know? Like, where there's enough other stuff that we could talk about that might, say, provide us with any kind of context where that exchange could occur, right? But all out there on its own, I have to say, well, it's awkward. Here's the thing. Very early on in my father's life, it became obvious that he possessed a beautiful singing voice. Untrained, undeveloped, it just emerged, strong, pure, remarkable. So, from a very early age, he was singing professionally, performing initially at bar mitzvahs. And it wasn't a huge leap from being the most gifted bar mitzvah boy to headlining in the Catskills. I could go back and check one of his two autobiographies, but from what I can recall with my, have I mentioned this, admittedly fallible memory mechanism, my dad was winning talent contests and appearing on local radio shows beginning at 12 or 13, so that by the time he was 15, he was officially discovered by Eddie Cantor. The upshot of this early career download is that my dad was treated like a celebrity from a very early age. He had six siblings, but his mother doted on him. He was her favorite, her sunny boy, dark-haired and adorable. The girls loved him. Whatever rules there were simply didn't apply to him. He was young, he was talented, he was handsome, he was Jewish. By the time he was 18, he was making more money than his father. And by the time he was 21, he was making more money than his father ever had. So what all this came tumbling down to was that my father could do no wrong. Or if he did do what might ordinarily be considered wrong for someone else, it was just one of the quirks found in the very special and gifted. In his universe, from the very earliest of formative years, his every gesture, every utterance, every otherwise inappropriate action was not only indulged, but in many cases celebrated. I don't say this to excuse him, but in a way, he was somehow guileless. I don't know how else to describe it. I mean, he seemed to be able to assume the best about others, especially women, of course, and was always, always up for a good time. Up being the operative word, of course. After the developing breast talk, I think there was a 7-year gap where instead of merely having no relationship, we had no relationship at all. Then, somehow, it was 1977. That year, everything changed. I was living in New York on the Upper West Side. Star Wars had opened recently, and I happened to be in it. And my life, I mean, what can you say after that? No, really, I'm asking you, what can you say? Well, whatever it is, there is every chance it would be said in a very weird robotic voice. Coincidentally, this happened at almost the exact same time when my term as a teenager was up. But because I had been in Star Wars for the first time, I could afford my very own apartment. I paid the rent with checks that had my name on them, money I'd earned by playing Princess Leia Organa in a movie that was so popular, so unbelievably fucking popular, that it took whatever my life had been up to that point and transformed it into this very different thing. I mean, sure, I'd spent my whole life around fame. Who hasn't, right? But that fame was generated by my parents. This shit was mine. Well, sort of mine, anyway. And by that, I mean that Princess Leia was famous. And I just happened to look amazingly like her. I mean, aside from her hair. But this was not dissimilar to the associative fame I'd lucked into with my scandal-generating folks. I now had this new and super-attenuated, dialed-up sci-fi fame, and if that wasn't enough, this fame came with Leia Organa's salary. And it was with that salary that I rented my very own semi-private apartment between 90th and 91st on Central Park West, 300 CPW. Yes, that's right, the El Dorado. Apartment 12J1 with its actual terrace quietly overlooking other buildings. No, it wasn't big or fancy, but whatever it was mine. Mine not only to live in, but to decorate and even invite people to. My life had begun. And gosh darn it all to Pete, it was gonna have all the earmarks of adventure and all the Groucho earmarks of fun. So there it was, spread out in front of me. What else could I do but hunker down and live it? So naturally, one of my first stops on this new life's journey of mine was, yep, you guessed it, dropping acid. Acid had become my new best friend, my drug of choice, my companion in chief. It agreed with me, whoever I happened to be at that sharp point. Something about it was more of the same, but in a way that was oh so very far from redundant. My experience of almost everything and everyone I encountered was always intense, but I found it difficult to believe that theirs was too. When I took acid with whatever friend I was lucky enough to take it with, I knew with an almost sufficient amount of certainty that we felt something close to exactly the same way. So it was a hot summer night in Manhattan, one of those nights just made for hallucinating. So my friend, and Jerry Garcia's friend, Mike, and I dropped some liquid Owsley LSD. Lying on a blanket on the terrace, gazing rapturously up at the night sky, with Keith Jarrett, the Grateful Dead, and Bob Dylan playing on the turntable, the volume turned up high, realizing our way to morning. So, with an ever-increasing appetite for closures, random and otherwise, my open mind stretching ever wider, wider, revealing out there, shimmering in the distance. Who was that? It appeared to be, why, yes, a man. That was it. Yes, a man. Silver-haired, half-pajama-clad, plum-eating, and Kent-smoking. It was... was it? Yes, it was. It was my stepfather. That flatulent, albeit well-groomed shoe tycoon. Say it again with me. Shoe tycoon. Harry Carl, the man who had disappeared from our lives, for very, very good reason, more than 5 years earlier, and to whom I'd never actually said goodbye. Yes. It was all too crystal clear. Now would be the perfect time to correct this oversight. So, with the acid as my guide, I picked up the phone and dialed the inexplicably remembered 10 numbers that would deliver me back to Harry. God, remember dialing? After enough rings to convince